Welcome to another edition of the Wrestling Daft Shooting Abuse Series. Today we're joined by none other than Robert Florence from Burleson. Robert, how are you doing?
Good.
Are you a fan of the business growing up?
Oh, I was a big fan of the business growing up. Ever since I was a small boy, knee-high to people that are taller than me. I was always into the wrestling, watched the British wrestling with my old man. Used to watch that with him. He was a big fan of watching the British wrestling. And then, of course, when the WWF boys came over, it was a big change, wasn't it? It was all change.
When did you get into show business?
When did I get into show business myself?
Yes. You went to school? Did you go to drama school, theatre?
Well, no, I didn't go to drama school, but I did go to... There was a wee drama group that met in Springburn. It was called Toonspeak. Still there, but it's under different... It's went through a few kind of ownership changes.
Any good road stories for
them? No road stories for there, really. You know, I went there and I was a very popular guy. My partner was always good, so it was somewhere I could go. And it was nice. It was a fresh start. Because you know what it's like when you're at school, kind of, and then you're like... I was always kind of all right at school, like in terms of popularity wise, but there was still the sense like, there were some people that thought you were a wee dick or something. I mean, or that you were quiet or whatever, you know what I mean? But once I came in at myself, it was good to go to a drama group like that where I was like quite confident. I could almost like a blank slate, could create my persona properly there. And had a good time in that drama group. That was where I met Ian Connell, who did.
I was going to ask you that.
All right, sorry.
I'm going to ask you that. When did you first meet Ian Connell?
Well, when I went to the drama group Toonspeak, I was actually had a mate called Paul Doonan. He was a guy.
I know who he is.
He's my mate at school, right? Paul Doonan. He's a great worker. And he, you know, I knew him. And he said, I know this guy, Ian Connell, you should meet him. He's at this drama group, you should come, you should meet him. He's got the same, very similar sense of humour. Ian was a year older, and he went to a different school. And I went along there, and I did kind of meet him, but we didn't really connect massively at Toonspeak, because he was a year older, like I said, and he was kind of like, he was like touring in wee theatre plays and stuff like that. And we didn't really completely connect there, but we... We started to kind of get to know each other, you know what I mean, towards the end of that period.
Was there any then that trained you 2 years, or was it basically make it up yourself?
We're self-trained. I mean, nobody we knew was doing comedy writing, comedy sketches, anything like that. That was a world unknown to boys like us, you know what I mean? You have to understand, this is a thing, it's... You know, the people out there, me and you, Grado, right? We can probably vouch for this, right? About how it's very difficult, and this is going to sound big headed, and I don't mean it in a big headed way, right? But it's sometimes you have to remind yourself what it's like thinking about getting on the telly before you've been on the telly, because it feels like a million miles away. Like when you sit in the house and you watch a telly, and there was like comedians on the telly when I was a wee guy. It felt like there's no way to go on the telly. There's no, you know what I mean? I didn't know anybody that had ever been on telly. My big sister once had been on Tiger Tim's radio program. She'd phoned in and made a phone call once, and that was like the biggest claim to fame kind of thing. Like, you know, my big sister had been on Radio Clyde talking to Tiger Tim once.
Uh-huh.
So it seemed like a million miles away.
Aye. And so then had you...
We had to train ourselves, really, you know. Self-taught, you know what I mean?
So you never had, at this point, you never had any conversations with Vince at this point, no?
Not at all. We were known as Radar. If you equate comedy to a kind of indie scene, we were backyarders. We were coming up. We were innovating. We were trying new stuff. At that time, Ricky Fulton was a veteran, right? He was a veteran. He was the big man. It was his territory. It was Ricky Fulton's territory when we were coming up. And Ricky Fulton's work in Hampton was going a bit stale. I thought, you know what I mean, Ricky Fulton's work was going a bit stale. He was going through the motions a wee bit. Everybody knew what Ricky Fulton was going to do. Reverend I.M. Jolly was going to do the flip at the corner post and all that right out. We knew he was going to do that stuff. And me and Connell kind of innovated. We kind of came in. We said, let's try some new stuff. Let's try and shake up the scene a wee bit. You know?
So when did you ask for your release at Toonspeak? How did you end up writing for... Greg Hemphill, or was there stuff before that?
It was merely an organic thing. Right. Toonspeak, we kind of moved away from Toonspeak. Connell went to uni. I went to uni as well. We both went away and started doing our different things. But then Conor got back in touch. He says, "You want to start doing a wee bit of writing together again?" I was like, "Aye, sure." I'd been writing away and you know, trying wee bits and pieces. But we got together, tried today. First thing we tried today, actually, me and Conor, was we tried to write this. It was like a crime serial drama thing, weirdly, called Miller, it was called. And it was about a... it was about some crap, some fucking terrible thing, right? I can't remember. But we started doing that. And then around about that time, Ian was still dabbling in doing a wee bit of acting, right? He was like, you know, he was tipped for big things as a young actor. You know, he was here and there doing, he was in a Greg's sausage roll advert. It was in an advert for a sausage roll, you know what I mean? Which is like, I mean, that's practically like being in a Marvel film, where we come from. And he, you know, he was doing that. And then he went for an audition at the BBC for a hang, right? It was just an open audition, and he turned up to do it. And he went in and he performed a bit of material, but he didn't get the part because he was rotten. He didn't get the part, but the guy said, "What was that bit of material you performed there?" And he says, "Oh, that's a thing me and my mate wrote." And he was like, "Excellent, you should send in more stuff, you and your mate." And that guy was called Neil Clark, and he was the guy who took us under his wing and brought us into the scene. And everybody needs that. I kind of feel like everybody needs that guy to bring him into the scene, you know what I mean? And Neil Clark was our one, you know what I mean?
That's amazing to hear that. So he basically... So you write stuff for... So basically, Ian makes you.
Well, aye. Well, I mean, really, if
well,
Ian...
That's unfair. Basically, so Ian goes for an audition. BBC see that. He puts you over. And then basically, this is your entryway into show business at this point. How do you
If he hadn't went for that audition, then it's hard to, you know, we maybe wouldn't have known. That was
you'd still be in indies.
That guy gone, we went, "I don't want you, but what's that material? Where did that material come from?" Oh, we wrote that, me and my mate.
So it was... Was it drama at first, or was it comedy?
No, it was comedy. That was a wee comedy bit. Right. That was a wee comedy bit we'd done.
Right, okay. So then what happens after that?
When Neil Clark gets us in, and the first thing...
does this take us back?
Oh, mate, this was when we got our first... It was maybe only about 8 months after that, maybe 6 months after that, we got our first commission for the BBC. And when we got our commission for the BBC, I'm pretty sure I was 18 and Ian was 19 when we got our commission for the BBC, and it was for a half-hour pilot thing.
Wow, so what year is this, do you think? You're 18, 19?
That would have been... if I was like 18, it would have been 95.
95, wow.
95.
Wow, amazing. So this is before even the kind of Monday Night Wars kick off, do you know what I mean?
It's predating a lot of that stuff.
Yep. So how did the boys in the locker room feel when you first started making stuff for the BBC, your first commission? What was the reaction?
Obviously there's always a lot of jealousy, you know, and there's always that kind of expectation that you've got some kind of inside track. But we were green. I mean, we were so good. You go back and look at that, the work we were producing back then, we were green as hell, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It wasn't over by any means, but we were feeling our way through it. Now, the next big step for us was we got a bit of work. This show started called Velvet Cabaret on Radio Scotland, right? It was called Velvet Cabaret, which starred... at the time, Gavin Mitchell, who went on to be Bobby in Still Game. That was how we met him. But that show started, and me and Ian Connell get invited onto the writing team for that, right? And so the next thing you knew, we found us in the locker room with a load of veteran comedy writers. I'm talking about guys like Ricky Brown, you know, some like proper old, dyed in the wool, like kind of older comedy writers. And they were all there and they were thinking, who are these two young bucks in here trying to steal our fucking heat in this company, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we came in, and I'll tell you what, we just outworked them. And I'm being completely serious here, because we'd go into a writer's room meeting, and Neil Clark would go, "Here's the stories, we want some sketches about this week." Off you go, turn in some work. And there would be guys that would be turning in, maybe like at the end of the week, they'd have turned in 5 pages worth of comedy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Me and Conor were turning in 20 pages a day.
Wow.
20 pages a day.
Did that lead to any ribs played on you guys at this point?
No, there was no ribs. I remember one story, though. There was a comedy writer that would be unnamed. We were young guys at the time, but I remember we were at one of the Velvet Cabaret radio recordings, and it was like, it was the end of the series recording. And so there was a party, there was a kind of rap party, and one of the older comedy writers turned up, and he turned up and he had two prostitutes with him.
I heard about this.
And we were just young guys, and he comes swarming in with a woman on each arm. And we were like, check him, man, we two. And we are so young and naive that we were like, he's got two girlfriends. Like, genuinely. Like, how comedy writers got two girlfriends? And then I went up to him at the bar at one point, and I was like, oh, and who is it you're here with tonight? And he was like, two prostitutes. Getting two prostitutes. Just said that. Well, like, but anyway, eventually he get trapped. You know what I mean? We walked him right out of the business, that guy.
Thoughts in the Chris Benoit document, the Chris Benoit tragedy, if you want to comment on it. You don't need to.
Well, it was a shock.
Where were you when you found out?
Where was I when I found out? Well, obviously the first thing I found out was that Chris Benoit was dead. Mm-hmm. And that was the first thing. It was a shock, and it was an outpouring of grief. It was like, Benoit's, oh my God, he killed, what happened? What happened? And then you find out the details about it, you know what I mean? And then it's dealing with that. It's dealing with how you look at the guy, you know. And I remember thinking to myself, how would I feel as well? Like, how would I feel if it was Ian Connell? If Ian Connell had killed himself and killed his whole family, mm-hmm. Killed his missus and killed his three boys, and a murder suicide and killed himself, I'd be like, how would I feel about that? The fact that nobody would be able to watch the 11 sketch anymore because a murderer was in it. Nobody would be able to watch Up the Road. Nobody wants to see a guy that murdered his whole family going, Up the Road. No, you know what I mean? Because you'd be thinking to yourself, fuck, a guy sent his own family up the road. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't know why you'd be thinking about that, you know what I mean? So it was a very tough time. But I remember there was a good laugh connected to that as well when I was in bed one night. I wasn't in bed. I was putting my daughter to bed one night, right? And I was in reading her a bedtime story. And I was actually in the bed beside her, snuggled up, reading the bedtime story, right? This is I'm going back a few years here now. And I got a text lit up my phone. And I looked at my text on my phone. It came while I'm hanging with that, and I just burst out roaring and laughing beside my daughter. And it was a text for Grado. And what did the text say, Grado? This was just on a random, like, Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. I hadn't heard for many ages.
I hadn't heard for you in ages, Winter, and I think the exact text that I sent you was, what was it again? Hold on, I'm just... The exact message I sent you was, the dogs are in the enclosed pool area and the back door is open. And then I followed up with, my physical address is Hislop Road, Stevenson.
Which made me, and the worst thing was, like, I couldn't even, like, it was one of the ones I couldn't even explain to people why it was so funny, because they would have to get the reference, and it was just the bleakest reference in the world.
Right? So you, at this point, so you're writing for programmes for the BBC. I remember watching Velvet Soup. Did you ever write the Bum Teeth sketch? I have this clear memory of that when I was young. Possibly no.
I have got nay.
Nah.
I don't know. What happened in the sketch?
Basically, I think Gavin Mitchell plays a doctor in the sketch, and this somebody comes in and complains about something in their bum, and he says dead straight, "Oh, that'll be your bum teeth growing in. That'll be your bum teeth."
I don't know. Possibly. I have.
She's a Wayne man. I thought that was the fucking best thing ever. That's your bum teeth growing in.
It's possible. It rings a bell. Honestly, it's like we've written so many sketches. Even ones with Burnston, sometimes people will go, I love that sketch, and we'll be like, can't remember that one, and it's one feet. It happens a lot walking down the street and somebody will shout something for a sketch, and I'll be like, what did that mean? What's that guy wanting? You know what I mean? Forgetting that it's a thing.
It is amazing. But so you and Ian wrote quite a lot of stuff for Chewing the Fat.
We didn't write anything for the first series. We got brought in the second series.
Right. And I love hearing this stuff, right? But
we get drafted over in the second
series.
Tell
us the story about you and Ian and Greg and Ford. What was it like? Was there any heat there at first?
Well, we were BBC boys. We were BBC mm-hmm. boys. We were in at the BBC, and Chewing the Fat was made by an indie, a comedy unit. And so that was our first work that we did for the comedy unit. They got us over. They heard that we were turning in power of work over at the BBC for Velvet Cabaret, and they were like, let's give these boys a shot at chewing the fat. And we came in, we got a lot of work on the go right away, and we had maybe a relationship with Karen Dunbar. We were kind of brought in, and they were like, we need more sketches for Karen. Everybody's writing sketches for the guys, but we need more sketches for Karen, so can you get us anything? So that was how we ended up writing like a taxi controller character for Karen and a teacher character.
Man, you've no idea. The teacher character was superb, man.
Cheers, man.
I used to do impersonations of that as a win for like my Moz pals and stuff like that. That was like, honestly, that's my dear school teacher, dear school teacher. I loved that, honestly.
Well, we did them, and then we just kept cracking on and doing the big man, and
big man's such a great character as well. Honestly.
Doing a bunch of stuff, and that was good. And then, you know, Ford and Greg were. And what was brilliant about it was how good Ford and Greg and Karen were. It was like, see being as, and this is knee harm to like the previous people we've written for or anything, because they were also good, but Ford and Greg and Karen were different class. So you would put a sketch in, it was a sketch you would like, and they would take it and they would make it even better, even funnier, you know what I mean, because of how funny they were at performing it. So it was a pure treat. It was exciting writing for Chewing the Fat, and obviously because Chewing the Fat was absolutely fucking massive as well, you know what I mean? It was a massive hit.
You think about it, man, it was like so much part of in the way folk in Scotland spoke. It was like everything came from like Chewing the Fat at the point, yeah. You know what I mean? And Gone in All Day That, and everything. I mean, it must have been your... It paid, you say, you're a young boy and all that, and folk are bringing out, I just see Chewing the Fat now. Like, are you going, I don't know.
Well, this is a thing.
You know what I mean? It's kind of fucking...
Before Chewing the Fat, it was like...
What he's talking about? I wrote that.
Aye, well, this is a thing. It was like, before Chewing the Fat, it was like, you know, you would get people going, oh, what do you do? And I'd be like, I'm a writer. And they're like, oh, what do you write? And then you'd be like, I wrote a wee bit for this thing and a wee bit for that. And they'd be like, oh, did you? Aye. You know what I mean? Like, it's nothing. But then you were suddenly able to go, you know, I'm a writer. Or, are you? Aye, have you done anything I've heard of? You'd be like, too fucking right, mate. I'm fucking Chewing the Fat.
So you and Ian sort of are like Vince Russo, ain't he? So
right, kind of.
And then he's want to be out on the screen. You want to get there.
I thought you were meaning because we wrote for the BBC and then the comedy unit kind of brought us over, poached us and brought us over, paid us better money. And then we did Chewing the Fat.
Oh, so I don't, oh, sorry. So at this point you were writing for the BBC
No, let me say, like, we had no real desire to perform on telly. And I would even say I still have very little desire to perform on telly as well. I do it now because, like, it makes sense, it makes money, I get asked to do it, I write my own stuff and all that, but I still consider myself a writer. I don't consider myself a performer at all, an actor at all. I consider myself a writer, so... It was never like a dream to break out and do that. See, I think Vince Russo was like, I want to be in the ring up front and people to see me, but it was never that for me. It was just, put it this way, that's how you make the money, as if it's your own show and you're in it yourself, you know what I mean? Because writers make nothing.
Right, okay. And so, how does Burniston come about?
Burniston came about because we are originally a radio thing, and it was a radio thing, and it was originally supposed to be about, I'm pretty sure it was an English documentary maker coming to a Scottish tune. They did a documentary about a Scottish tune, and then we started writing like the funniest characters that he met and all that, and then it started to develop, and let's just make it, and I'm pretty sure we recorded that radio pilot exists somewhere, where it's like, it's almost like a documentary. It's completely different. And it's out there somewhere. I don't know where
it is. Is it mockumentary style?
Kinda, aye.
Wow, what year is this?
This is like 13 years ago or something, 14 years ago. And, you know, and it was like sketches about like the journalists talking to like guys that breed dogs, like dog owner, the guys that are dog breeders and stuff. Yeah. It was starting to feel like Burniston. It was still that kind of daft, like weirdo characters. And then when it got a bit, we were like, let's try and change it for telly. And then we just started to move towards making it more about a sketch show, just a straight sketch show. Mm-hmm. And that was when it became Burnison, but it all seemed to happen weirdly, kind of reasonably fast. You know what I mean? I think they were looking for a new sketch show.
Is at this point, are you about to join the wrestling business? Or is there a couple of years before that? When do you first start working in the wrestling?
This predates that. What happens? I'm pretty sure this predates me doing it in SWA because it was run about that. It was when things started to kick off for us with that. That we started. No, actually, it was before Burniston that we were trying to get NWA UK Hammerlock on the telly, and that was before then we started getting. I'd get in touch with Andre Baker, mm-hmm. at Hammerlock, and was like, right, let's try and get a pitch together for a telly program. So that was before Burniston happened.
And so what's your initial impressions of meeting somebody in the wrestling business? Obviously, Andre Baker, the late Andre Baker, who's responsible for quite a lot of the British talent that kind of made it for the 90s, early 2000s. You've got your Johnny Mosses, Doug Williams was trained yep. there, Johnny Storm, I think even Alex was there, Jody. Mm-hmm. What was your impressions of turning up?
Andre Baker you hear a lot of talk about what a kind of hard man Andre Baker was, you know what I mean? There's a lot of talk about, but he was a total gentleman with us, and we were just, you know, we were just, again, just young guys. And he was a total gent and a smart guy and a kind guy. And it was weird. It was fantastic. We went down to an NWA UK Hammerlock show in a wee town down in England somewhere. I can't remember the name of the town, and that was where we first kind of saw Johnny Moss, doing his stuff. And it was the first time we got a sense of what it was like backstage at a wrestling show in a wee hall in a wee town. You know what I mean? And it's just, you know, like, you know yourself, it's an incredibly addictive scene. It's like going to see the circus, isn't it? It's like going to see circus, and then you're like, man, I want to fucking run away with the circus and just live this life. You know what I mean? And you just go at that right away. I mean, you know, and obviously, I was never going to be involved in the wrestling scene in the ring. So
you had never any. Did it let you take a bump in the ring, or were you ever that kind?
It was never that kind of thing. No. It was very much. Writing. It was very much come and see what our product is like.
Right.
Come and see who our workers are. At the time, it was Gary Steele.
He was NW champion at one point.
He was a champ. It was Gary Steele. It was Paul Vault. It was Johnny Moss. It was Nikita.
Nikita, that's right. Who ended up going on to be? What was her name again? And Winter, is it? Was it Winter? Her name was.
I can't remember.
What was Nikita's name in WWE again? Was it Nikita? Was it Nikita?
Maybe it was Nikita in WWE. I can't remember. But it was all them. And so it was about looking at them and, you know, trying to work that into the pitch and work, you know, just kind of work with the guys. And
Katariana. Katie Lee Burchill.
Katie Lee Burchill.
Mm-hmm. Aye.
So it was great. And it was good. Aye, and the tag team, which was called Seek and Destroy as well.
Who was Seek and Destroy again?
I can't remember.
So what happens? How do you get involved in SWA? Does Conjurts, who was at NW Hammerlock at the time, do you meet him down at Hammerlock and he tells you, look, I'm in the process of creating a wrestling company in Scotland? Or right?
This was a few years later, and this was just me, and this was just purely for going. Initially, I went, maybe I'll start a wrestling promotion. And then I had a Google, and then I was like, oh man, there is a wrestling promotion, and it's no
Kenny Morrison, were you ever exposed to him?
No, but he was a name that was always, so I'll be honest, it's a shoot interview, but it was somebody that was always getting slagged off by people. You know, this is all I know, and I don't know anything about the guy, and I'm no doing the guy down because I don't know any details about it. But I remember when I first turned up on the scene in SWA, it was like people were always, stuff had went down, and I have no idea what that stuff was. But there was a lot of people being like, aye, fucking him. He nearly fucked everything up or whatever, you know what I mean?
I mean, that time the wrestling business was wasn't that big. One, I know there was probably about like 20 names in total, and that's including trainees and people that already wrestle already and stuff like that. And
as Kent, we know, you hear these stories and you don't know who's telling the truth or who's, you know.
So there was Scottish Championship Wrestling, and it was run by a guy who never had any experience in wrestling before, but he gave it a bash and he promoted in promoted in Linwood, where Drew Galloway made his debut. And then I think it didn't draw much, but you know, yourself, eventually Conscience, who was wrestling in Hammerlock at the time, and I think he hadn't been to OVW at that point, but anyway, Conscience took over the Scottish Wrestling Alliance. He changed it from SCW to SWA. So I remember, what was your impersonations of bumping into a young Grant Dunbar? Because I have this vivid memory of meeting you for the first time. I think it's maybe 04, 05. We've got Titantron videos, we've got cameras walking about. I meet you, and I actually think, when I first met you, I thought you were a right quiet guy, and I actually thought you were maybe a wee bit nervous backstage at a wrestling. I was nervous as well, but I thought you were quite nervous as well when I first met you.
I think it was me. I was always with SWA, I was always keeping my mouth shut, was me what it was, you know what I mean? I wasn't wanting to be... One of my main things that I always had in my head with SWA stuff was that I didn't want to be giving people any false impressions about what might happen. I mean, the whole objective with being at SWA was still working towards, let's see if we can get some wrestling back on telly again. It was still that, but it was trying to do it a different way. With NWA UK Hammerlock, people would get their hopes up. You know what I mean? One of the most important lessons you can learn about telly is never get your fucking hopes up until the contract. Am I right? You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. I'm still learning it, to be honest with you. I'm still trying to adapt to that.
Until you get a contract signed, until it's first day of shooting and you're stoning there, don't get your hopes up. And at Hammerlock, people would go with their hopes up, you know what I mean? And then when things didn't happen, you feel bad about that, you know what I mean? And I remember when I went to SWA, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to be there. I'm going to film stuff. I'm going to shut up. I'm mainly going to kind of talk to Conscience. I'm mainly going to talk to Conscience and mainly going to talk. I mean, who did I really have a relationship with? It was mainly Conscience, and had a good relationship with Big Adam Shame, obviously Big Shamer, and Canyon, and mainly people that were the trainers. You know what I mean?
I mean, I personally drew on MSN. I can remember.
Probably
MSN as a wee guy, man. I totally remember that, and I can remember. I can't remember what it was, but something that you had wrote or been involved in was on the telly. And I remember like telling my family, like, and the credits came up and it came up Robert Florence. I was like, I know that guy. He comes to wrestling. He's involved in wrestling. I know that guy for telly. I know him.
Yeah. So Robert that Florence. And I remember seeing yous, and yous really did look like wee guys. Yous really looked like yous were so young. You know what I mean? Yous were young though, right?
Oh, man, I was 14, 15 year old, man.
That's, I mean, yous, totally. And yous really looked like wee guys. And it was... And sometimes you were wrestling people that look kind of like men. Do you know what I mean?
We get battled, man. We used to get battled, definitely. And I didn't know the difference between a fucking wrist lock and a fucking wrist watch. It was bananas.
But it was amazing to think, because when you look back at the days now, when I think about SWA now, you saw everybody come through their doors, really. You know what I mean? Like, all the people that are involved in the scene now, even like people like Lionheart and Drew, you saw them all, Wolfgang, you know what I mean?
It was mental, right? Because do you know, like, so SWA, in British wrestling shows at the time, it was a matter of six matches, you know, tag match, maybe a rumble at the end. But SWA, Conscience had big ideas, didn't he? If you went to Bell's Hill for a wrestling show, John, it was basically like the show would... What's that?
It was like SummerSlam. It was like...
Mate, there was like... John, you have no idea, like the lights went out, and then they come back on, and then like there was factions who started after the show. It was like Monday Night Raw. They tried to make it like Raw, do you know what I mean? And it was like storylines that went for like March, and then the next show would be in the middle of July. And like, I think the fans were like, sorry, the promoter was expected the fans to know the storylines, wasn't it? It was a bit mental, wasn't it? I remember my brother going to a show going, what the fuck is all this about? It was like that, wasn't it? Did you have any involvement with that?
Peter Disney get the credit he deserves for some of that stuff, because you know, that period that period, he was gaining the value for money. He was gaining people who paid to go into their shows was outrageous. I thought, you know what I mean? It's like you say, they were big, big, long shows. They were stacked full of matches. There was promos.
Coffins.
There was storylines. Storylines developing throughout the night. You know what I mean? Right. There was spectacle as well. Like he was, you know, he really pushed himself as like a star attraction. You know what I mean? And you felt that in the way it was all presented. You know what I mean? And there was
a great gimmick, mate. You had a great gimmick.
There was good matches as well. And there was some real high points. You know what I mean? There was low points and all, obviously, because there was a lot of very kind of green guys out there. You know what I mean? But there was still, everything was presented in the right way. You know what I mean? And I think that period, he probably deserves more credit than he gets, I think, in the story of kind of Scottish wrestling and where Scottish wrestling went, you know what I mean? Because nobody was going to their shows and no coming back. You know, he had returning people that were coming back month after month to see these shows because they were getting amazing value for money. And they were having a fucking... And I remember, because I was there with a camera, I was filming it, and our people were having a fucking... The crowd were loving it.
Because there was a draw, man. There was some shows, 400 or 500 folk in Matt Busby Centre in Bells Hill. And sure, remember I told you when we'd flyer folk with ads, Big Conscience, and sure the guy in the street went, Big Chancer wrestling night, Big Chancer. Fucking bit, you know what I mean? Folk knew who he was. They followed it, and they came every month.
But also... It wasn't like people came because, oh, it'll be a nice thing to do with the Waynes, and then they would just sit bored and sit in their horns watching it. People were in it. People were, because they were trying things. Like, they were constantly trying things. They were like, well, let's stick up a cage. We'll have a cage match. Let's have a casket match. Let's have, you know what I mean? And there was, like, people blading, and there was all sorts. Do you know what I mean? There was all sorts happening.
Aye. I mean, well, blading, I remember the time, I don't know if you were...
Shamer was breaking his leg on it.
Oh, that was incredible. We need to get Adam Shame on the show, man. I actually feel bad that he's not been on this yet.
You need to get him on it.
We need to get him on. So, Burniston, when so about 2010, Burniston is piloted, is that right?
2009.
Aye.
When I was 20 stone.
Right. That's another thing as well. That's, you were really, and you were a chubby man, and you've managed to keep that weight down. You are now like a skinny guy, and it says on Wikipedia Robert Flaunce is vegan. You're not fucking vegan.
No, I was vegan for a month, and then the vegan mob are so extreme and desperate. They were like, right, he's been vegan for a month, we're claiming him, he's ours now.
Aye. Never mind that. What about, because I'm forgetting that you, when I first started hanging about with you, and folk knew you for this video guiding.
Video guiding.
The guy that you done it with, remember, he blocked me. He's blocked me on Twitter. I don't need to talk about that. I've no idea. I don't remember who he is, what he's called. I've no idea why he blocked me, but I blocked him right away.
A bit of beef.
I have no idea where that beef came from. I have no idea. Why does he not like me?
Maybe he just doesn't like you. I don't know.
He doesn't like me. He doesn't like me.
Maybe he just doesn't like you.
I don't even know. I'm not even bothered. Anyway, enough. Video again. Charlie Brooker's screen white. I'm just reading stuff. I have Burniston here. Would you call it Wikipedia?
Well, I have a huge history of doing video game related stuff. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? On telly and stuff like that, which has always been good.
When did you meet Frankie Boyle?
When did I meet Frankie Boyle? That's a good question. I was working... when I was working on Velvet Cabaret, or it might have been Velvet Soup, actually, the teleprogram, I had a mate called Alan Miller, who was a script editor on that show, who's one of the funniest guys I've ever known. It was for Edinburgh. It was a stand-up, and he was like one of the most mental stand-ups I'd ever seen. He was hilarious. And he knew Frankie for the stand-up scene. And he was like, you need to meet Frankie. And in fact, we kind of go together to kind of, let's see if we can write some stuff and all that. And if you've he's sitting in a room, I think we went up to, was it maybe Alan Miller's flat, and Frankie came up. And then we're sitting like flinging ideas about, and Frankie was just fucking, it was like, I don't know, it was like inviting a ninja and a black belt, a comedy black belt into the room, you know what I mean? And that was kind of when we all first met him, kind of. And then I kind of, like, stayed in touch with Frankie. ended up being, you know, being good pals and, like, still really good pals to this day. Obviously, I'd tramadol nights with him and stuff like that. And he's always been good. He's a very generous guy, Frankie. He's a very, like, he looks out for... There's a lot of guys who get big and then forget other mates, like, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And Frankie was a guy who got big and never forgot all his mates, you know what I mean? Was always checking up on them, always helping them out, always, like, flinging a bit of work their way if he could. Always, like, you know, just a really, really generous guy who's always been, like, just a good guy, you know what I mean?
Memories.
No many good guys in this game.
Ah, you're right. Memories of Tiger Ali Singh.
Never worked with him. Oh, right, ships are passing the night. Right, ships are passing the night.
She's here, right? Okay. So Burniston starts. You're on the screen. How do you adapt to the celebrity lifestyle? You've went for being a backstage personality. You're put front and foremost in front of the cameras. How do you cope? Are you, is there heat for other guys in comedy that you're on the telly?
Well, you would see. I remember there was like a forum called the Scottish Comedy Forum or something, and it was where all stand-ups would all post. And I remember there you would see loads of people sniding about.
Was it poisonous? That I can imagine it being poisonous.
Aye, basically any program that go on telly was getting fucking pelters. And I remember that. And also we weren't the stand-ups either. So how dare we? Just go on telly. So I remember there was a wee bit of that, but no, I mean, we'd been about for a long time and we knew a lot of people, and I think most people were kind of pleased for us for getting the show, but also, you know, it's, you look back, it feels different looking back on it, but the first series didn't do that well, you know what I mean? It did well enough to continue, but it's not like it was a big, massive hit. It wasn't like chewing the fat ratings, you know what I mean? It wasn't popping their ratings. It was, did all right. Aye, the numbers are looking pretty good. There was still plenty of people that weren't watching it. It's not like you weren't walking about and hearing people hitting out with Burniston part on the street or anything. That's all happened over time. Over time, Burniston's became big.
Aye.
But at the time, the first series came on, it was kind of like, oh, will we get a second series? Don't even know if we'll get a second series. It's not like, so there wasn't a huge adjustment to make. It's no, you know what I mean?
So Do you think you never really got the chance to enjoy it, if you know what I mean? Because there always was that pressure. I think possibly was there a turning point when you started to do live shows and you were selling them out and managing to take it to across the country and you go to shows and everybody knows the gags, everybody knows what's coming, you know.
The only sad thing I would say about Burniston, the only regret maybe about Burniston is that we wrapped it up after the third series.
Aye.
Because... kind of the BBC kind of says to us, look, boys, don't know how much further we can really take this. We kind of get three series and they'd all done pretty well and we were really happy with the third series and we kind of felt we'd been doing well with it. And then we were like, right, let's wrap it up here. And actually Burniston get bigger after that. If we had been as popular at the time,
mm-hmm.
as we are now or have been over the past few years, we probably would have kept going. You know what I mean? We probably would have done series 4, series 5, series 6. But at that time, after the three series, it hadn't really caught on in a massively big way. Weirdly, it was kind of, you know, it caught on well enough, but it's been since then, since Facebook and since YouTube and people swapping them about and all that and things going viral and all that and, you know, our specials have done well. When we've done a wee special here and there. Obviously, the dream is we'd still love to do Hogmanay, you know what I mean? We'd do Burniston at Hogmanay every year in a heartbeat, you know what I mean? But...
What is the plans for you? I know you had the Sunny, which I was just reading up about then, which I've spoken about this before.
Well, let's save this for part two because we could really go in on that one.
Aye.
So because we were bait in that. We were both in that, so that's a good one. Eh?
We can talk about what we can do is we can talk about the Sunny. We can talk about the Scots. We can talk about what else were you in again?
Two Doors Down. Oh no, it was you. It was in Two Doors Down. We can talk about all that stuff. Coming.
Any Owen Hart rib stories before we go?
No, Owen was a joker. Everybody knew Owen was a right joker. We stayed far away from Owen because we knew we'd be a soft target for him. You know what I mean? Two kind of naive boys.
So I think what would be the best idea to carry on this for our Patreon stuff like that. We've had a wee bit of a shoot interview series here, but me and you were speaking earlier the day about the next part of this interview series, and we couldn't get talking about the Sunny, we couldn't get talking about everything else wrestling. Mm-hmm. On a flight, a Captain Grado flight. I'll get you in the cockpit. You can be my first officer. I'm obviously the captain. We'll get a flight on the go. We'll fly from. Where can we fly for?
Why don't we go and visit? Why don't we go and visit my father-in-law in Azerbaijan?
Tidy. So
could you fly to Baku, Azerbaijan?
I can go to Baku. We're on our way to the Baku. We can do that. Absolutely no bother at all. I've got Baku Airport. There is a few landing strips there. So we'll jump on. I don't think I'll take my 747. I'll probably take just a bit of a. I'll probably take the A320-200. So we'll get that on the go. John, you're very much welcome to come and join the flight. And everybody else that's part of the Patreon can be part of the flight, and we'll take off and we'll get in touch with the fans and have a wee bit of a live stream. You want to do that?
That'd be amazing. Getting the fans input as well. And, you know, and just having one of the wild plane journeys, you know what I mean? Peeing on the stewardess's leg and all that.
Plane ride for hell.
Exactly.
That's what we'll call it. Plane ride for Bell's Hill.
Audio Frontier.